business to the bed. It gets beyond all the headlines you read. Don't need it service with a wink and a nod. You need a man on a mission from God. Well, not to worry, here's Bob in your life.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Well, this Saturday, my son Zachary is going with the Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, the whole Denver area scout group is going to a place called Dinosaur Ridge, and that's on a major interstate, I-70, heading from Denver into the Rocky Mountains, and there are dinosaur fossils, footprints of dinosaurs, there are bones, and of course, the people who run the site, Friends of Dinosaur Ridge, they believe in evolution, that man evolved from animals, and that the earth is billions of years old. And I was somewhat concerned all these Boy Scouts and Cub Scouts are going to be given a big dose of evolution. And that was so sad, especially since so many of these Cub Scout groups and Boy Scout groups are Christian. They meet in Christian churches with Christian parents. And so I got on the phone. I started calling around, called the Boy Scouts, called our local troop and den leaders and the downtown area. I called the Answers in Genesis. I called Bill Jack and his group, BC Tours. And I kept hearing this name, Dr. Ed Holroyd. And this Dr. Ed, from what I could tell, he is a scientist, worked with the government for 30 years, and he's got a degree in astrophysics and a PhD in atmospheric science. And that he is an expert on the geology of Dinosaur Ridge and what it teaches us, and that it shows that it's not millions of years old, perhaps, but that it could fit in with the Bible time frame of human history. So we started getting on the phone, and we desperately hoping that the Cub Scouts and the Boy Scouts on this Saturday can hear a Christian perspective of Dinosaur Ridge. And so I am so thrilled to let you know in the audience that Dr. Ed Holroyd, he's not just a theory, he's real, and he's right here in the studio. Dr. Holroyd, welcome to Bob Enyart Live.
I'm glad to be here.
It's so great to have you in studio and to realize that you will be there this Saturday, as you've been for 16 years now at Dinosaur Ridge. And what do you teach students and adults when they come by?
I teach in general what is at the plant fossil site. And I have a couple of card tables there, and one card table has a microscope on it with lots of rocks. And I show in this on that table, I talk about plant fossils and identification of plant fossils.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it turns out that the plant fossils at Dinosaur Ridge are basically chips of charcoal, and you don't see whole plant remains very well. And though there are some stem impressions, some leaf impressions, stuff like that, bark, but it is not really very easy to identify those plants just from looking at those shapes. And so then I talk about dissolving the rock in powerful acids and looking for the pollen that is mixed in with the sand grains.
Oh.
And from the shape of the pollen, it is sometimes possible to tell what types of plants were in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And then I show them under the microscope real ponderosa pine pollen, which is a little sphere with a crease down one side.
Okay.
Very distinctive. All pines have that shape.
Mm-hmm.
Then I show them a field guide to the pollen, showing the same shape there in the field guide. And then I show them a picture of fossilized pollen, which has exactly the same shape.
Okay.
And so I'm basically trying to show that, yes, it is possible to identify types of plants in the region from the pollen that is hidden amongst the sand grains.
Wow. And, of course, we find pollen, fossilized pollen, around the world in all kinds of geologic strata. And so that teaches us, we get information from that, and then we interpret the information. So as you're showing them this, what are you driving at? Are you driving at anything in particular, or are you just trying to show them here's how you could look at something scientifically?
For most of the public, I am just trying to get across, here's a new way of looking at rocks and trying to identify plant fossils. Mm-hmm. Usually it does not go beyond that.
Okay.
But some people ask me the loaded question of where did that fossilized pollen came from?
Mm-hmm.
And it came from the bottom of the Grand Canyon, Hecate Shale, second sedimentary layer up off the granite. And to have pines at that stage is an evolutionary no-no.
Isn't that Precambrian?
Yes, it is.
Now, Precambrian, people in the audience have all different kinds of interests, and not everybody reads science as a hobby. But I've heard of the Cambrian explosion, where evolutionists, they claim that it takes hundreds of millions of years for life to evolve gradually, and they take the geological record of the rock strata on the Earth, and they say the deeper down you go, the older in the past, the more ancient past you go to millions and billions of years, and at this one layer, there is an explosion of life of virtually every kind of life generally that we have in the world today we find in the fossil record. And so that's startling to them. Why do they appear so quickly? Okay.
The Burgess Shale is the big example up in the Canadian Rockies.
Okay. But so when we find pollen at a Precambrian layer in the Grand Canyon, what does that tell us and what does it tell the evolutionists?
Okay, for us, that is consistent with the biblical record of creation, that God created all things, the trees, on the third day. And so there were functional pine trees right from the start. And you would expect to find pollen from those trees within the earliest sedimentary layers. From an evolutionary point of view, that is not, they can't go along with that finding at all. The guy who discovered that pollen was denied his PhD because of that. And the evolutionists will claim contamination in that. But modern pine pollen, which would be contaminant, would be yellow in color. And what was found in the sediments was red in color. It was stained by the rock and the ages in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate that the CRSQ magazine and the scientists behind that, which published this a follow-up on this, didn't get a lot of samples of the pollen. They got a few grains of it. I would really like to have seen a lot more pollen extracted from that rock.
And CRSQ, I just happen to have here on my desk, Creation Research Society Quarterly. This is a group of scientists. In fact, to be a voting member of CRS, Creation Research Society, you have to have an advanced degree in one of the physical sciences.
Yes.
And I think they have over 600 voting members.
Yes, they do.
Which is extraordinary. These are people who believe that God created the Earth and mankind in the recent past.
There's a similar magazine, TJ, or Technical Journal.
Fabulous.
From Australia. This has similar content.
Answers in Genesis. And their work, you know, it seems to me, Dr. Holroyd, that over the last 20 years, the quality of research and writing coming out of the creation movement is just improved dramatically. Do you see that?
Yes, I do.
And it's really super exciting.
How could you go down to the second table then?
Okay.
On the second table, I have just lots of rocks and some samples from a landslide that happened from a forest fire site. And at this table, I am trying to show the nature of the plant fossils. I demonstrate that some of the plant fossils, I can see charcoal in the rock. And if you look under a magnifier, you can see wood grain within that charcoal. I also show rocks that where the charcoal is missing, but hematite hardening against those plant tissues has preserved the wood grain very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the wood grain and the fractured end perpendicular to the wood grain, I can show that only charcoal is going to fracture perpendicular to the wood grain.
Oh.
Green wood, if you break it into small pieces, you'll have a frayed end.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very understandable to the general public.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So I'm able to show at that table that, yes, we are dealing with charcoal that was all broken up before it was deposited in the sand.
Mm-hmm.
And then go into the physics of charcoal and sand mixtures. and I say going to forest fire sites, and I've looked for the mixture of charcoal and sand. And at most forest fire sites, there is no charcoal within the sand. And the problem is buoyancy, that in any plant matter, even if waterlogged, is much more buoyant than sand in a water environment. And so the charcoal will float upwards and be definitely on top of the sand, maybe on top of the water itself. Mm-hmm. So that's what we normally expect, that we would find a charcoal layer sitting on top of sand. And I do have examples of charcoal at a bedding plane. And so that's all understandable. But then I show them rocks where the charcoal is mixed all the way through. And that's not explainable by the buoyancy problem. And for that, I went to the Storm King fire site over beyond Glenwood Springs. And I sampled that 3 days after a big landslide occurred that blocked the interstate. Mm. And went in there and took corings of that. It's all fresh mud and so on, and x-rayed it and dissected it and sorted things out very carefully. And I found that the charcoal is indeed mixed all the way through that layer. Mm-hmm. So that tells me that a catastrophic flow of mud and debris can create the mixture, but not an ordinary flow. Due to the buoyancy principle. And mm-hmm. the public generally understands the buoyancy very well. I even have a jar there with a mixture of a sand, a charcoal, and water, mm-hmm. and which I've shaken up, and the charcoal goes right to the top all the time.
Wow.
Right to the top of the sand.
Mm-hmm.
So then I apply that to the rocks that are at my site
right.
in the road cut. And
now,
I see
in the road cut, we put I-70, Interstate 70, through this ridge of mountains west of Denver,
mm-hmm.
and we call them the Hogbacks.
Right.
And you could see the strata. There's the Dakota, the Morrison, all these strata, fossil-bearing strata. And so you're able then to take some of those rocks and then go ahead, proceed.
Yeah. Well, actually, we're in the next road cut south of that, where Alameda Parkway goes over the Hogback, and there I see the plant fossils a lot better. At the I-70 road cut, it's all ground into powder. You'll see black powders there.
Mm-hmm.
So at Alameda road cut, there I see some of the charcoal that's at bedding planes, and that's what we expect. But then I show lots of it where the charcoal is mixed all the way through, and I've already demonstrated physically that if I shake up my jar, the charcoal goes to the top of the sand
right.
in 5 seconds.
Right.
And so that shows that these other layers had to be deposited in a fraction of a minute, each layer.
Oh, my.
And so then you add it all
Wait,
up.
Wait, let me process that. There are multiple layers.
Yes.
And they have charcoal mixed through with the sand.
Yes.
And if they were deposited over a gradual period of time, then that charcoal would separate.
Lift out, yes.
It would lift out. But if a layer got deposited rapidly and then another layer right on top of that immediately, there wouldn't be the opportunity to separate.
That is correct.
Okay. See, even I could yeah. understand this.
Right.
And we're talking to Dr. Ed Holroyd, for 30 years a scientist with the U.S. government, in fact, the Department of Reclamation.
Bureau of Reclamation.
With the Bureau of Reclamation on projects like dams and hydroelectricity and irrigation. And by the way, thanks for your service in doing that all those years. And now Ed is retired as a scientist, but you're a professor at DU, University mm-hmm. of Denver. And every month, one Saturday a month, first Saturday of every month, Ed is at Dinosaur Ridge, and he will be there this Saturday when the Boy Scouts are coming, and probably in large numbers, to look at the fossils, the dinosaur footprints. And Ed, you've got a long history in the Boy Scouts.
Yes,
I do. You're not only a scientist, you're an Eagle Scout.
Yes. Started off with my grandfather being an Eagle Scout. He got his Eagle in 1915. And then my father and all his brothers were Eagles. And my brothers were all Eagles in addition to myself. I was the first third-generation Eagle. And now my brothers, their sons, are becoming Eagles. They're fourth-generation Eagles. So I have a very long history. Even my mother was one of the last Girl Scout Eagles.
So that when my son comes through, he's a Cub Scout, when he gets to your tables, not only will your scientific credentials be obvious, but your Eagle Scout credentials too. That's exciting. So, okay, could we proceed with, I'm getting the picture. You show the kids and the adults. Here's how the charcoal separates out quickly, but what we find is it's mixed throughout the layers.
Yes. And so then I ask the question, how much time is there between the layers? And for that, I look at the bedding plane lines. I look for vertical disturbances due to animal burrows, tree roots, or soil formation, anything to break up those lines.
How about normal erosion from wind and water?
Yeah, that, too, would be there. I'm looking for something else that might be faster.
Okay.
And more permanent. And turns out in that entire cliff face, that road cut, there is no such evidence. And so, therefore, I say there's not much time between the layers either.
Wow. Now, when I go to the Grand Canyon, our family, we love, when we take family vacations, we go to nature sites, the national parks. And the Grand Canyon bookstores now sell the Grand Canyon A Different View, which is a young earth view of how the Grand Canyon was formed, which is so exciting.
Yes.
And I, every time I go, we buy a couple more of those books and we give them to tourists. And I stand at a very popular view site and just offer to chat with families that come by, and they want to talk. And I ask them, I say, look at those strata. Look at the perfect uniform boundaries between 100 layers of strata on the opposite side of the Grand Canyon. We're looking to the north. And I ask them, if it took millions of years for all those layers to form, don't you think wind and water erosion would really deform all those boundaries? They wouldn't be perfectly straight for 100 square miles. And they look at it and they say, that's true. Why are they perfectly straight? And really, it's probably 1,000 square miles of incredibly uniform boundaries between 100 layers of strata. And so what that tells us is it's not true that it took millions of years for those layers to be deposited. Am I analyzing that properly as far as...
That's a good viewpoint there, that the different strata came in successively and very rapidly. There are some stream channels in one of the limestone layers labeled DB on the geologic maps. It's down near the Red Wall and Muive limestone area. But Steve Austin, a few years ago, discovered that the Red Wall limestone has one particular layer of nautiluses. There's basically like a carrot thing, 2 feet long, very straight. And they're all lined up parallel to each other and were deposited there catastrophically. And it covers all those hundreds of miles. He's traced this layer. And so he is the one who has discovered this. Before that, fossil finds in that layer were not being discovered. But this shows that Red Wall limestone had to be deposited catastrophically.
What are those things, these 2-foot-long conical shapes? What are they?
It's more like a squid or a chambered nautilus. But instead, chambered nautilus is all spiraled up.
Oh.
This is all straight, but it's the same type of animal.
Oh, my. Wow. Stephen Austin, he's such a neat guy. We sell his video on Mount St. Helens. And it is just the neatest video to show. He did a lot in helping us to understand how after a cataclysmic event, trees will get waterlogged and sink vertically and get embedded in the bottom of, let's say, a lake. And as layer after layer of sediment falls, the trees sink, and they sink upright vertically, and then they get embedded in different layers. And then you got 1,000 years later, and people think, well, these trees grew here in successive forests over millions of years. And he says, no, look at this on video. I've got it right here. This stuff happens rapidly, and that's what happened at Yellowstone. At Yellowstone, the petrified trees, they used to say, they don't any longer, that these trees represent remnants of forests that grew up in successive eras, and they're standing right where they grew, and then the forest got wiped out, and a few trees petrified, and then it happened again at another layer and another layer. And Dr. Stephen Austin and others pointed out they have no roots, those trees. Their roots are all broken off abruptly, 2-3 feet from the base of the tree. These trees were broken. They were knocked over by some catastrophic event like a volcano, and they were transported by water, and they sunk, and that's how they got there. Pretty neat science.
Yeah, all because of Mount St. Helens showing us how that happened.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Dr. Ed Holroyd, who not only has been a scientist with the U.S. government, retired now for 30 years, a professor at University of Denver. In fact, you teach remote sensing, right?
Yes, I do.
And that has to do with satellites and aircraft. And
looking at the Earth from those perspectives and working with the pictures to extract information.
That's pretty neat. And with that expertise, why don't we throw in, let people know that you have also helped creation scientists consider a claim of a find of Noah's Ark, where during World War II, there was a gentleman who thought he saw Noah's Ark. This has been widely reported for decades now. Noah's Ark broken in two locations, and you've helped people understand what he saw. What was it that he saw?
Yes, it turned out to be an optical illusion. In 1943, he was trying to construct a road through western Iran to give supplies to Russia to fight against the Nazis.
This was Ed?
Ed Davis, yes.
Ed Davis,
yes, so he's an army engineer. And then during a week off, he was taken up into the mountains by the locals. And there, under very poor seeing conditions, he made this observation that he thought he saw Noah's Ark in two pieces. But he didn't tell anybody for the next 43 years. Then in 86, he was debriefed by a bunch of people looking for Noah's Ark, and an artist was able to draw a sketch of the layout of everything that he saw. That was a very accurate layout because he was an army engineer. Yeah. But still, nobody could figure out which mountain he was on. The debriefers, of course, thought he was on Ararat in northeastern Turkey. But the geometry of the layout just didn't match anything up there.
Mm-hmm.
A year ago, last Thanksgiving, through the use of satellite pictures and some ground photos, I discovered what mountain it was on. It was Mount Suleiman, northwest of Tehran in northern Iran.
Mm.
And all the geometry matches beautifully of the site. I can pinpoint just everything that he was looking at.
What he saw and where he thought he saw a chunk of the Ark.
A lower object turned out to be a lateral moraine, and an upper object that the rocks were in block formation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was verified by an expedition last July. They didn't get to all the sites that I was pointing out, but they did verify, yes, I did have the mountain correct.
Mm-hmm.
And that was using my remote sensing skills.
And so that was helping the creation science movement. We believe that the Bible, God's Word, is a literal account of man's history. And so we want to know the truth. And if there is a sighting, a claim that maybe Noah's Ark is sitting on a mountain and it's not true, we want to know that's not true. And so you've helped us in that negative way, mm-hmm. say this possible sighting was not a sighting. This was an optical illusion.
Yes, and so therefore, if we want to continue looking for the Ark, we go to different mountains. And I've looked at through satellite pictures at all of the mountains under consideration, and it is not visible on any of them at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have the modern technology to look, so we might as well.
Yeah.
There's nothing in the Bible that says we need to find Noah's Ark in the last days. It would be very nice.
Yeah.
But so I'm not disappointed either way.
Right. And the fact that the Bible says that the earth was covered with water, and we go up on these mountain ranges all over the earth, and we find fossils of sea creatures, clams. And that, to me, that's rather extraordinary, because when Moses is writing the book of Genesis, surely he couldn't have any human view that this would be true, unless, in fact, it was true, and he had good reason to believe that the mountains had all been covered with water.
Or that the land that had been underwater during the flood was lifted during the process or slightly thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
Like Bob Cornuke brought back clams from this Mount Suleiman. So that was up from a high location. And Mount Everest has such shells up on near its summit, too.
The Rocky Mountains, how about finding marine fossils in the Rocky Mountains?
They're probably there.
Yeah.
And I remember over on the West Slope where I used to live for a while, there's shark teeth in the Mancos Shale.
Right, exactly. And, okay, so when we as creationists, when we look at the data, if the data says, no, this is not Noah's Ark, we want to know that. We don't want to, like NPR Radio, National Public Radio this morning, they did a spot and they were actually mocking young earth creationists. And they were saying how teachers in public schools have a problem now because so many kids come in armed with questions and challenges. And they said, look, respect the kids' beliefs and tell them that you have reason and you have faith. And so by saying that, they're suggesting that faith is the opposite of reason, which, of course, is an insult to Christians. But that's NPR's gig. That's what they do. So, okay, we only have another minute or so. You'll be at Dinosaur Ridge this Saturday for the Boy Scouts. In fact, the first Saturday of every month.
During the warm season, of course.
During the warm season.
May through October.
May through October. And so people listening, if they'd like to get a Christian view of the geology of Dinosaur Ridge, they could come up there. And the hours that you're normally there, the first Saturday of every month?
When it's open. I arrive before 9:30 to set up my equipment, and then I'm there until people disappear. So I'm there long after 2:30 closure.
Okay, that sounds great. And for people out of Colorado, I-70 is a major thoroughfare for people on vacation, tourists. And so if you're coming through, remember, if it's the first Saturday of the month, look for Dr. Ed Holroyd there at Dinosaur Ridge. So Dr. Ed Holroyd has agreed to stay with us for the second half of the show. And if you have any questions you'd like to ask about creation, evolution, the age of the earth, that's a great time to call in at 1-800-8-NYARDS. That's 1-800-836-9278. We'll be right back. And eagle eggs. When does an eagle become an eagle? Mount Moriah, the evidence for the resurrection, and God and the death penalty. And then there's video fruitcake with hilarious liberal callers. So call in and ask for the Bob and Yurt Live catalog or get it on the web at kgov.com. Of course, all these materials are listed and described on the internet, or call us at 800-8-NYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. We'd love to send you a Bob and Yurt Live catalog, so give us a ring. We're back, Bob and Yurt Live, and we have in studio Dr. Ed Holroyd. And Doctor, again, it's an honor to have you here. Thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
There is a book published by Master Books called In 6 Days, Why 50 Scientists Choose to Believe in Creation. And, wow, Dr. Ed Holroyd is right here in this great book. So it's there's so much in our world to remind us that God created us. And we've been talking about Dinosaur Ridge, and the typical position by the scientific community is that it's millions of years old. And you're there showing that these strata, there's evidence that they were laid down rapidly. I want to ask you about carbon-14, because we've gotten calls over 15 years. Now and then, someone will call in, a student, even a high school science teacher, and they'll say, we know the Earth is billions of years old because of carbon-14. And when I say that, I just can't even believe my ears, because carbon-14 can't say the Earth is millions or billions of years old. It doesn't work that way.
That's correct.
Could you explain to the audience why carbon-14 can't do that?
Okay, carbon-14 has a half-life of 5,730 years, more or less. Very short.
In other words, in 5,000 years, about half of the carbon-14 atoms will degrade.
Yes, degraded to nitrogen-14.
Because it's unstable, so it'll no longer be carbon-14. So you measure how much carbon-14 you have after a period of time, and you could sort of gauge time by doing that.
Yes, it's an exponential decay, mathematically very simple a process to understand.
So, and how? Give us an idea how long it would take a chunk of carbon-14 to decay.
Okay, you take a gram of pure carbon-14.
A little gram.
1 gram, like okay. A little cube.
Yeah.
And in today's ratio, which is measurable, and you let the carbon-14 in that decay, the last atom of carbon-14 would decay to nitrogen in about 250,000 years.
250,000 years,
yes.
It'd be gone.
Yes.
That sounds like a long time. but it's not millions or billions of years, 250,000 years. What if you had a big chunk of carbon-14?
Well, let's go to the absurd case.
Okay.
Say that the entire Earth was only pure carbon-14.
The whole Earth?
The whole Earth.
Okay, the Earth is one big blob of carbon-14, and now it's going to decay.
Yes. It decays into nitrogen in a half million years.
1.5 million years.
Yes.
So that if the whole Earth was carbon-14, it wouldn't last. Not an atom of it would last for 1 million years.
That is correct.
500,000 years, it would all be gone.
Yeah.
So do we find carbon-14 out there in strata that's supposedly millions of years old?
Yes. It turns out that in all fossil fuels, there is measurable carbon-14.
Now, they're supposed to be millions of years old.
Yes, even hundreds of millions of years old.
Right. We're talking about oil.
Oil. And yeah,
coal,
crude oil,
natural gas,
coal, charcoal that I've done. I've done samples up in northeastern Wyoming, and it also included dinosaur bones and amber. And there's measurable carbon-14 in all of these samples.
Mm-hmm. And so that should be startling to people who believe that these fossils and petroleum and diamonds are millions of years old when they hear that carbon-14 is found in these substances.
Yes, and you just mentioned diamonds. That is a recent discovery that carbon-14 has been found inside diamonds, and there's no way through biological processes that could have gotten in there.
Now, one of our scientists, America has these national laboratories, and one is Los Alamos. And one of their scientists made that discovery, isn't that right?
Yes. He's left that and joined Institute for Creation Research now. That scientist, John Baumgartner.
John Baumgartner. And he's a geophysicist or
yes.
something like that?
He has created the world's best numerical model of the convection in the mantle of the Earth.
Oh, that's right. He wrote a software program basically to model, simulate the crust of the Earth and – isn't it called Terra,
I think,
his program? And that's used by geologists, geophysicists all over the world.
Yes. In fact, I went to an AGU conference where he was the host of the session on numerical modeling of the Earth.
Wow.
Because of his prominence.
Is that the American Geophysical Union?
Yes.
Okay. And so he's obviously extremely capable scientist.
Yes.
Fully accredited and should be acceptable to the secular world as far as his scientific expertise. And so Baumgartner was he the first one to look in atoms for carbon-14?
I don't know if he's the first one, but he definitely has done that recently. After going through coal deposits and stuff like that and always finding carbon-14, he then decided to try diamonds as an absurd case, and he found it there too.
Because diamonds are supposedly how old? I don't know, but millions of years old,
yes.
We're told.
Precambrian.
And so we should like carbon-14. I mean, we always have, of course, you know, whatever. God has created. We're pretty thankful for the Lord's creation. But the evolutionists have taught millions of students that carbon-14 proves their evolutionary theory. And it's actually the reverse. Carbon-14 is being found everywhere, showing that it's all young.
Yes.
That it's not millions of years old.
Yeah. Now, some people will try to say that carbon-14 is being replenished. It is created in the upper atmosphere by cosmic rays, and then it comes down through the carbon cycle, through carbon dioxide, gets absorbed into plants and other animals and so on. And then when the living creature or what substance dies, then it's trapped and starts to decay. So, yes, there is replenishment going on all the time, but for the fossil fuels deep underground, there's no way to get modern carbon down into those layers.
And into atoms, for example.
And into diamonds.
And so we go down, scientists now with Creation Research Society, they published an article, I think their last quarterly magazine, and it talked about carbon dioxide wells in North America. And they had a scientist go to, I think, 4 out of the 6 wells, and they took samples from thousands of feet below the ground or however deep, and millions of years, different strata. And all the samples showed carbon-14 and all about the same amount of carbon-14, showing that these were all deposited about at the same time and recently, not millions of years ago.
I'll just take your word on that. Yeah. I've also heard that in natural gas, there was a scientist who was trying to get a source of natural gas to put in a scientific counter for measuring something else, and he could not find gas that was radiometrically older than 70,000 years. Mm. It was all contaminated with some carbon-14.
Isn't that just extraordinary? Yeah.
Now, all of these ancient samples here, they may come up with radiometric dates of, say, 10 to 40,000 years ago, which is beyond the biblical time scale.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't really need to be worried about that because back before Noah's flood, the atmospheric conditions were different, and there could have been a different rate of production because of variable stars and stuff like that, but mm-hmm. also different ratios of carbon 12 to carbon 14. There was a tremendous amount of carbon in the biosphere before the flood. That's all captured now in our coal deposits mm-hmm. and our petroleum deposits, and maybe even some of the carbonate rock. The ratio was different. It was much a smaller ratio, and so there would be the appearance of greater age for mm-hmm. those deposits.
Like, for example, while it's a very complicated subject, if you look for the presence of minerals in the oceans and you look to see, well, how much nickel is in the ocean waters, how much gold is there, and then you look at how much of those minerals are running off the continents, and you see, wow, this certain mineral – that much of that mineral could be collected in 80,000 years. It doesn't mean that the Earth is 80,000 years old, because some of that mineral could have started in the ocean, and also during Noah's flood, that could have deposited more minerals, of course, in the oceans. But it gives an outside length of the age of the ocean. It's probably not millions of years old, because there'd be a lot more sediment on the bottom of the ocean. There'd be more of these minerals in the ocean.
A lot of substances like that, taken from a uniformitarian point of view, that say there's a definite limit of maybe even tens of millions of years for some things, like salt in the ocean, beyond which it's impossible.
Mm. So how about at Dinosaur Ridge? They've done radiometric dating to see how old those dinosaur fossils are and all?
Yes, there is a particular ash layer, volcanic ash, on the west side of the road cut where I do my demonstrations. That has been sampled by a government scientist. He extracted zircon crystals out of the volcanic ash and then took them to Canberra, Australia, where a very sensitive instrument was used to determine uranium and thorium and lead isotope concentrations. And the number came back that the impurities in the zircon crystals indicated a radiometric age of 106 million years. And that was exactly the lower Cretaceous age that they wanted, and they quit right there. The write-up of this study indicates that the Dinosaur Ridge area was a big lake at that time, receiving sediments from the former Rocky Mountains, and so you got an influx of sediments, which contained lots of zircon crystals coming off the mountains. And then you had the volcanic ash, which was falling into this at the same time with its own zircon crystals. And they made no attempt to figure out the source of the zircon crystals that they measured. If they came in from the sediments, then the age that they got applies to the mountains that are far upstream mm-hmm. and not to the time of the volcanic deposit. And so that's a vast difference that could be that the volcano was much younger than their indicated age.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've gone in there with a X-ray fluorescence device, which shoots gamma rays into the rock, and then X-rays come out, which indicates the different types of elements within the rock. Zirconium is the critical element here that is in zircon crystals. And I found that there's zirconium all through that road cut. I measured every 2.5 meters through there. And in the volcanic ash layer in question, there was a decrease in the amount of zirconium. less than in the neighboring sediments. And then in another ash layer, there was more than in the neighboring sediments. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, these scientists never sampled the neighboring sediments to see what the zircon crystals looked like there. And if I get time, I would like to extract those zircon crystals in this neighboring sediments and continue the study as they should have done long ago.
Very good. I once asked a geologist with the USGS, the United States Geological Society. He had been with them for 30 years. Seems like all you scientists have done everything for 30 years. I don't know why that is. But he had been with them for 30 years, and he worked with Friends of Dinosaur Ridge. And a friend of ours owns land out there with dinosaur footprints and fossils. It's pretty neat. So we surveyed my friend's land and then went to Dinosaur Ridge. And I asked him this question. I said, in your career, do you have samples radiometrically dated? Send them off to a lab, and he said, "Oh yeah, we've done that." And I said, "When you do that, do you do it in a double blind way, or do you make sure that the lab doesn't know where you're getting the sample from?" And he said, "No, why would we do that?" And I said, "Well, isn't that a scientific way of making the results more objective and less biased?" And he said, "Why would we have any bias? We're scientists." And it just blows my mind that they say, here's a sample from Dinosaur Ridge, which, you know, dinosaurs are supposedly 65 million years old, and they get back dates of 100 million years. And I think it would help, at least for credibility for the general public, for them to do these double-blind methods where the lab doesn't know where the sample is coming from, and the expected age is just a complete unknown to the lab.
Or at Dinosaur Ridge, they should also look at the zircon crystals that are in the shales above and below that ash layer, mm-hmm. and see if they get the same date or a different date.
Now, when you mention these crystals, I know that the RAPE project has looked at helium and how helium will leave crystals over a period of time. Can you first, Ed, could you tell us about the RAPE project that's going on? Do you know a bit about that?
The RAPE project was run over a period of several years by Institute for Creation Research and also Creation Research Society with a number of contributors. Mm-hmm. And they were looking at lots of both theoretical and practical measurements relating to radiometric dating and other indicators of the age of the Earth.
In other words, if we take potassium argon or different dating methods and we say, okay, this here strata is 140 million years old, then creationists say, well, we see your data, but we disagree with your interpretation. So now creation scientists are trying to systematically understand how radioactive decay has affected the world we live in. Right, so that's the RAPE project.
Yes.
And one of the things they're finding, for example, like you mentioned, John Baumgartner has discovered carbon-14 in diamonds. And we find that there's carbon-14 in fossil fuels everywhere you look. That's exciting to me because that shows they're not even a million years old. They're a lot younger than that. But now the RAPE project, this again, another article I've read, and you may not have read it, but in Creation Research Society Quarterly, maybe from 6 months ago, they took crystals and were going to measure the amount of helium in these crystals. And they have a good understanding at the rate at which this helium would extrude. I don't know if that's the right word. And so they published an article before they did any of the measurements. And they said, based on an old Earth, here's the amount of helium we should find in these crystals. And based on a young Earth, here's the amount. And they were different by about a factor of 10,000 or so.
Five orders of magnitude.
And so they sent this to a high-precision laboratory, I think, in Canada. And the results come back, and the results are then published subsequently, and they match. You can overlay almost perfectly the young Earth prediction with how much helium is actually in the crystals. And you compare that then with the old Earth prediction, which is five orders of magnitude greater. There should be that much more helium, and it's not there. That's pretty exciting.
Yes. Well, actually, there is plenty of helium in it. These are also zircon crystals. That,
right.
Very exactly. durable and a very high melting point, twice that of most other silicates. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, they measured the diffusion, is the proper word, the diffusion of helium out of these crystals. And that is a function of the temperature to which they are subjected. Mm-hmm. So they measured the temperature of this borehole in New Mexico all the way down and then looked at the amount of helium remaining in the crystals. And they did find that at the hotter end, deeper in the earth, there was less helium. So they got the diffusion coefficient measured very nicely. Mm. But they, yes, there is a lot of helium in the crystals. That indicates that there was a lot of radiometric decay as well, basically millions of years worth of radiometric decay. And so then they have a quandary, yes, but that happened not long ago.
Oh.
And so this is starting a new way of thinking for the creationist community. We are not all up to speed on this yet, on the implications, but they are claiming that, yes, there was all this radiometric decay happening, mm-hmm. but it was only a short time ago because of all the helium is still in the crystals.
It seems, talking not as a scientist but as a Christian, that when God made the earth, that in the original creation, we wouldn't have had this radioactive decay on the earth where an alpha particle shoots through your body and happens to hit one of your chromosomes, maybe in a woman's ovary, and then she has a baby and the baby has a genetic deformity because of the natural radioactivity. It seems like before perhaps Noah's flood, perhaps, at least at the beginning of the creation, there would not have been this radioactive decay that we know of on the surface of the earth that is damaging to life. Seems that way to me. And so somehow something happened, possibly with the cataclysmic events that the world suffered through Noah's flood when the fountains of the Great Deep broke up, something happened that caused radioactive decay, that process to begin.
Or to accelerate.
Or to accelerate.
Obviously, there in the past, even on the evolutionary time scale, there was a lot more radioactivity in the past because, like for the uranium and lead and so on, it has this half-life, and you work backwards by these exponential decay rates, and it certainly had to be increased in the past.
Mm-hmm. This has been just fascinating, but Ed, your interest is not only with science, it's also in the area of biblical history, archaeology in a sense, in that you have quite a collection of coins, biblical coins. And I heard you say something years ago that actually when your name came up this morning, when I was concerned about my son going to Dinosaur Ridge and he's going to be told about evolution in millions of years, and people are telling me, well, there's a creation scientist, Ed Holroyd. And I thought, Ed Holroyd, who is this guy? It turns out you and I met about 7 years ago. And I only remembered that later today. And you had shared with me your biblical coin collection, which has encouraged me ever since then. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. I've inherited a few coins from the biblical period from my grandfather in the late 50s. But then around 1980, I felt led of the Lord to see if I could get a few more that I did not have, like a shekel and a widow's mite. Mm. I soon discovered I could get them from mail-order coin dealers. There's only a dozen of them around the country because there's not much demand for such coins. Mm. And soon my whole exhibit or collection escalated in around 3 years to now cover about 8-foot tables with all my write-ups.
Mm-hmm.
So I now have all the coins mentioned in the Bible, lots more coins mentioning rulers or cities and so on, verifying that the history given in the Bible is real history. It's not fairy tales.
What if we were to compare that with, say, the Book of Mormon, which many of us believe is just a fabricated novel, just a fantasy history?
Alma chapter 11 mentions an elaborate coinage system of gold and silver coins. And the chapter header talks about Nephite coins. Now, the Mormon missionaries will say, well, that doesn't necessarily be Nephite coins is not inspired word in their point of view, and it could have just been bags of powder or something mm-hmm. like that.
But the text they claim is inspired.
Yes. But there are no such archaeological discoveries of such coins anywhere. It turns
or those monetary units or values in the Book of Mormon, they've never been discovered independently by archaeologists.
No. And you could make a statement that there is no society on earth that has ever made coins all to have every last one perfectly vanish.
Oh, what a good point.
Yes.
Because coins are rather durable.
Yes.
They're made of metal of some kind.
And you always find them in the dirt or a crack or mm-hmm. down a well or something like that.
Right.
They show up eventually.
Right. Good point. And so the Bible, is it accurate to say every coin mentioned in the Bible can be found?
Yes. I have them.
You have them. And, in fact, people could see them on the Internet.
Yes. I have them mounted at this address, 3ws.ccu.edu. That CCU is Colorado Christian University here in the Denver area. And then / biblical coins, all as one word and plural.
Okay. So
3ws.
CCU.edu for education / biblical coins. That coin collection of yours has encouraged me over the years because it's something I may have never noticed to tell people that, hey, another piece of evidence that the Bible story is real is that it's verifiable.
Yeah, and this physical exhibit that's behind all this has now traveled to 5 continents, sometimes without me.
Oh, really? We've done our own research and found, and we list the names of 100 people in the Bible who have extra biblical attribution, where historians and archaeologists have found outside of the Bible evidence that these people were real people. They're not just made up like the angel Moroni, for example, actual real people in history, and God intervened to save us through his son Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and that's what my exhibit tries to show. This is real history that the Bible talks about.
Mm-hmm. So we've been talking with Dr. Ed Holroyd, and if you're interested, you could pick up the book In 6 Days, published by Master Books, Why 50 Scientists Choose to Believe in Creation. And one of them is Dr. Ed Holroyd, and also his website at ccu.edu/biblicalcoins. Dr. Holroyd, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
All right, and we will see Dr. Holroyd again this Saturday morning, when my son Zachary and I, 8 years old, we go to Dinosaur Ridge. So God bless you guys, and check out KGov, KGov.com.